Welcome everyone to this afternoon intimate session of the ISO. I'm Polly, I'm from Oakland branch, and we're going to talk about the 30-year anniversary of the Nicaragua Revolution. And together with Steve Lee, he's a member of the ISO from Seattle, we're going to talk about like what happened before the revolution, how the revolution took place, like the politics of it, and how like the years after, what was going on politically in Nicaragua. So without further ado, because we are a very small group and we'll have plenty of time for discussion, Steve will take it from here, and he will be talking for around 30 minutes, so we'll have plenty of time for points, discussion, questions, and everything.
Okay, great.
Please welcome Steve.
Thanks. Great to see everybody here. So 30 years ago this month, one of the biggest victories against U.S. imperialism that's ever taken place in Latin America took place when the people of Nicaragua rose up and overthrew the 45-year dynasty of the Somoza family. This revolution was led by the Sandinista Liberation Front, the FSLN. After this 45-year dictatorship was overthrown in a matter of months, and it was not easy. Somoza had held on to power to the last, in spite of prodding from the U.S., which saw the handwriting on the wall. They knew he was going to go. He didn't know that he was going to go, so he stuck around till towards the end. Over the months of the Civil War, Somoza's National Guard killed 50,000 people. And this is a country of about 5 million people, so it was a very high percentage of the population. And they destroyed much of the productive capacity of the country, bombing cities, factories, and hospitals. The insurrection was led by the FSLN. However, much of the energy of the uprising came from the urban poor, from the unemployed, the partially employed, the part-time workers, the street vendors, and, of course, the stable urban working class, which made up less than 20% of the city's the population of the urban areas. And at that time, it was mainly an urban insurrection, because Nicaragua was already at that time about 60% urban. So the overall goal of the insurrection was the overthrow of the Somoza regime. But besides the FSLN, the political leadership of the rebellion included representatives of the business class, who were members of the first revolutionary junta. The goal of the new government was the rebuilding of the economy in some form of democracy. The new junta called for a mixed economy with state and private ownership of the economy coexisting. Indeed, through most of of FSLN rule until 1990, 60% of the economy remained private. And this was, of course, a government which was denounced throughout the world as being Marxist and so forth. But it was still very much a mixed economy, certainly no more publicly owned than many Western European countries, for example. The uprising was overwhelmingly popular. People tore down the hated symbols of the Somoza rule, including his statues. Now, just to look briefly at some of the conditions that led to the insurrection. The infant mortality rate in Nicaragua was 46 per 1,000 live births, which is very high. It's something like five times what it is in the U.S. today. The literacy rate was 57%. Unemployment, even before the insurrection really started, was around 22%. The division of wealth was really extreme. 50% of the population of Nicaragua subsisted on only 15% of the wealth, whereas 5% of the population got 30% of the wealth. This 5% had an annual income of about $5,000 a year, whereas the majority of the population had an annual income of only $280 a year. It was one of the poorest countries in Latin America, and there had been a shift, as I said, of people from the rural areas to the urban slums. From 1966 to 1977, the shift went from 60% rural down to 40% rural, and the rest of the folks went into the cities, primarily in the slums. There were worsening conditions during the recession and rising urbanization. What led up to the insurrection was, we'll get into this later, as to why this happened, but the U.S. was emphasizing a new kind of human rights policy and suspended arms sales to the Nicaraguan government. Somoza, in order to get the arms sales back, lifted the state of siege and kind of opened things up. But that led to the FSLN launching armed attacks and an increase in populist struggle. In 1978, one of the key things that happened was that Pedro Joaquin Chamorro, one of the leaders of the opposition, the bourgeois opposition, the capitalist opposition to Somoza, was assassinated. He was a publisher of La Prensa, a newspaper, one of the main newspapers in Nicaragua. Somoza was blamed for this. Now, some people argue that he wasn't really behind it, but he was in any case blamed for it. And the bourgeois opposition to Somoza intensified because they came to the realization that, yes, there had been repression against poor people, and poor people had been shot and jailed and so forth, but you can't go around killing people in the ruling class. That's not allowed. And so they were really upset about this, and they began to go into opposition to Somoza. There was a spontaneous uprising in the city of Matagalpa in 1978, and shortly after that, the FSLN actually briefly captured the parliament building and held the parliamentarians hostage until they got some of their folks out of prison and got some money. The FAO was the leading bourgeois opposition group, and it began to call for U.S. intervention. And then a group of 12, that is, of the bourgeoisie, of the capitalists in Nicaragua, formed in support of the FSLN. Also in this year, the FSLN reunited. It had been divided, and I'll get into what the divisions were in a little bit, and created a 9-person directory representing all of the 3 factions in the FSLN. There were soon after that risings in León and Esteli, and the FAO, the bourgeois opposition, called for mediation. And soon after that, a United People's Movement was formed, and then in February of 79, a popular revolutionary front, which were, again, combinations of the FSLN and other oppositions and the capitalists as well. In January, Somoza broke off talks with the FAO, and the level of struggle intensified to the final victory. The arrogance of the Somoza family was phenomenal, and this is the way it often is with people who have been military dictators for 45 years. This was recounted in a book called Revolution in the Family. Colonel McCoy, a U.S. official, asked Taquito, who was Anastasio's son, the son of the dictator, why he couldn't convince his father to resign and permit an orderly transition, since it was clear that the people of Nicaragua no longer wanted him to run the country. Taquito asked McCoy, what Nicaraguans are you talking to? Well, my gardener and my barber, for starters, said McCoy. Taquito suggested that he get a new gardener and change barbers. So it's a variation of the old saying, when the people loses confidence in the government, it's time for a new people. That was kind of their attitude. So the U.S. tried to work with the FAO to manage a transition to a broader bourgeois rule to preserve the state structure, the National Guard, which the U.S. had set up years ago. But Somoza would not budge until the end. And even then, his successor, Urquijo, took over for a few days, refused to turn over power to the new junta. So the revolution kept on going, and the National Guard itself, that is the basis of the state, was destroyed. And that's the one thing the U.S. did not want to see happen, but it happened because the government was so stubborn. Now, the background of this, I want to go briefly into the Nicaraguan history and the U.S. relations to it. In the 1890s, there was a rise of coffee in Nicaragua, and there was a new bourgeoisie which promoted liberalism or free trade. There was also the beginnings of proletarianization of the countryside, because people who had lived on small plots of land, subsistence farmers, were driven off their land and driven into working on the coffee. There was a liberal, ironically named Zelaya, who was the president of Nicaragua in 1893, and he was overthrown by the United States in 1909. This is the same name. I'm not sure if there's a relationship between the leader of Honduras, who was just recently overthrown. By 1912, between 1912 and 1933, the U.S. had occupied Nicaragua in the face of a liberal uprising. The U.S. was opposed to the liberal Zelaya government because the government wanted to try to increase relationships with the Europeans and get more European investment, and the U.S., of course, wanted to dominate and control Nicaragua itself. So the Marines occupied Nicaragua in the face of a liberal uprising, took over the control of the customs and the railroads and the banks. But by 1926, an agreement was worked out with the liberals and the conservatives, and a liberal, Moncada, took over as president. However, Sandino was one of the liberal generals. held out against this agreement. He was in favor of nationalism, development, some development of co-ops, and he made appeals to the workers and peasants as well. So this was part. This U.S. intervention was part of the larger pattern of U.S. intervention in Central America, Latin America in general. And this was well expressed by a general named General Smedley Butler, who was a Marine Corps general in the United States. And he said of this whole period, "I spent 33 years and 4 months in the active service as a member of our country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for the Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer for capitalism. Thus, I helped to make Mexico safe for the American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the national city banks to collect revenues in. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1909 to 1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916, and I helped make Honduras right for American fruit companies in 1903. And this is basically what the U.S. was doing, trying to dominate all of Latin America, especially the Caribbean and Central America during that period. But by 1933, the U.S. had decided that direct intervention in Nicaragua was too costly, and they were sure to set up a National Guard to take over their interests in Nicaragua. And this consolidated an agro-export model of Nicaragua, that is, most of the goods that were produced for export like coffee, cotton, and so forth, and cattle, dominated the economy. And this is the case for 25 years. Eduardo Galeano, who wrote Open Veins of Latin America, which is available for bookmarks, describes Somoza this way. He said, "Somoza ruled Nicaragua for a quarter of a century and then bequeathed the job to his sons. Before wrapping the presidential sash across his breast, that is while he was just head of the National Guard, before he was officially president, Somoza had conferred upon himself the Cross of Valor, the Medal of Distinction, and the Presidential Medal of Merit. Once in power, he organized various massacres and celebrations for which he dressed up his soldiers in sandals and helmets like the Romans. He became the country's biggest coffee producer with 46 plantations and raised cattle on 51 haciendas. But he was never too busy to spread terror. He was a dictator that the U.S. freely backed to defend its own economic interests and support its foreign policy. This is why Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 1940s said of Somoza, 'He's a son of a bitch, but he's ours.'" And this is the U.S. attitude, and that was what they backed for 45 years. Now, through the course of the Somoza family's rule, there had been opposition from the bourgeoisie to a certain extent because they were being cut out of a lot of the deals. Somoza was monopolizing mostly a big chunk of the economy. So there was back and forth agreements and then breaking off. In 1956, the first Somoza, Anastasio Somoza, was assassinated, and his son Luis took over. And he began to liberalize things a little bit and even allowed a civilian president from 1963 to 66. In 1967, after Luis died, Anastasio II, the final dictator, took over and ratcheted up repression. 1972, there was an earthquake in Nicaragua, which was actually a very big turning point because a lot of the city of Managua and other areas were destroyed, and there was international aid that came in. The Somoza family monopolized most of this aid and refused to allow the other bourgeois interests to make money off of it. So that really pissed them off very heavily, and that caused a real rift. Now, as far as I want to go briefly into U.S. relations with Nicaragua. After the Cuban Revolution, the U.S. decided that, you know, they were worried about their proxies being overthrown in Central America and throughout Latin America. As John F. Kennedy, the president, put it, "Those who make peaceful reform impossible make violent revolution inevitable." And therefore, they wanted to put forward a reformist program in Latin America to consolidate U.S. domination and consolidate ruling class rule, realizing that they had to give a little bit in order to solidify things. However, the Alliance for Progress always had an element of repression in it. And they also didn't want to press reform too far to alienate their own supporters in Central and South America. Frank Coffin, a deputy administrator of AID, put it, "Our basic broadest goal is a long-range political one. It is not development for the sake of development. An important objective is to open up maximum opportunity for domestic private initiative and enterprise, and to assure that foreign private investment, particularly the U.S., is welcomed and well-treated. A strong private business community provides a powerful force for stable, responsible government and a built-in check against communism. So this is their whole approach, even though they tried to put a reformist veneer upon it. As a result of the Alliance for Progress, there was a shift away from primary goods production to a certain extent and towards investment in manufacturing, like maquiladora type of manufacturing in Central America. Foreign investment went up from $30 million in 1960 to $300 million in 1970, with 83% of that being U.S. investment. And under John F. Kennedy, the main threat to U.S. interests was no longer seen as other European countries and so forth, but as internal threat because of the Cuban Revolution. They set up the military assistance project, and military aid doubled in the 1960s from what it had been in the 1950s. And this is the era, of course, of the training of troops and officers, especially by the School of the Americas. In 1964, they formed CONDECA, which is an alliance of Central American countries. And then under Richard Nixon, arms sales rose. In 1970, the U.S. brokered a pact between the conservative opposition and Somoza to keep Somoza in power. And by 1978, Central America was more dependent on export sales to the U.S. than it ever had been. However, again in the mid-70s, as a result of the U.S. loss in Vietnam, there was a shift again towards emphasizing supposedly human rights as part of foreign policy. And this happened even under Ford, before Carter came in. Carter is, of course, identified with the human rights approach, but it really shifted before that as a result of the loss in Vietnam. It's explained by James Petras this way. Morality is the recurring ideological expression of U.S. imperialism in a period of crisis. It is what is offered to the world in place of substantive changes in the world's economic and social order. Or as Denny Pierce put it in Under the Eagle, human rights was at the center of the strategy to restore the credibility of U.S. foreign policy. But human rights policy in accommodation to third world demands were acceptable insofar as they were seen to coincide with and even promote national security interests, but they would not survive any real conflict between them. So the real thing was still national security, but the cover was human rights. There was also a greater use of the IMF and less of the CIA, although the CIA was still involved. So they were squeezed economically and forced into neoliberalism and so forth through those mechanisms. After the assassination of Chamorro in 1978, the U.S. vacillated between supporting Somoza and trying for a solution of what they call Somocismo without Somoza, that is the same structure without the current dictator. As late as 1978, Jimmy Carter sent a letter to Somoza praising him for his new found human rights record in Nicaragua. The U.S. asked the OAS, the Organization of American States, to mediate between Somoza and the opposition. And they began to do that. The U.S. also pushed for an actual military occupation of Nicaragua by the Organization of the American States in 1978. For the first time in the history of the OAS, they actually refused the U.S. demand and said they weren't going to do that. The U.S. for a while did not want to even see just a government based on the bourgeois opposition, but they wanted to maintain an element of Somoza in power. The U.S. cut off military aid officially in 1979 and cut off an IMF loan to pressure Somoza. But then as the FSLN began to grow and looked like it was going to take over, the U.S. reinstated the loan because they wanted, if they had to choose, obviously they were going to choose Somoza over the FSLN, although they wanted another solution that would have been a capitalist solution, which would have been more stable. After the Sandinistas took over, the U.S. tried to steer it in a bourgeois direction, trying to put pressure on it to continue to support bourgeois interests. And then, of course, there was a shift in strategy under Ronald Reagan, where they decided that the FSLN was not going to accommodate the bourgeois interests enough, and they moved to overthrow the Sandinistas through the use of the Contras, which resulted over the course of about 8 years in the death of yet another 50,000 Nicaraguans. Because of U.S. intervention. Now, briefly, I want to talk on the history of the opposition, especially of the FSLN. Okay. as in the 1950s, as I said, there was a rise in manufacturing in Nicaragua. The number of unions went up from 5 to 18 in 1958 alone. So there was the beginnings of working class opposition as well. In 1961, the FSLN was formed in Honduras. It was influenced by the Cuban Revolution and had the same theory, which was that they wanted to get mass support in order to put the guerrillas into power, as Castro had in Cuba. There was a rising working class struggle in Nicaragua between 1970 and 1974, but the FSLN had virtually no relationship to that. During this period, many radical Christians joined the FSLN. And in 1974, the FSLN gained notoriety by kidnapping a bunch of capitalists, taking over a bourgeois Christmas party and holding them for ransom and so forth. However, this caused a division within the FSLN. They weren't sure how to deal with that. And two tendencies began to develop. One was called the prolonged people's war tendency, which believed in organizing in the countryside in a guerrilla method and gradually surrounding the cities. And then the other tendency was known as the proletarian tendency, which believed in organizing the working class. From 1974 to 77, they were relatively isolated. But in 1976, a new faction within the FSLN formed called the Terceristas, or the Insurrectionists. And their approach was to water down the goals. Instead of having a Cuban-style government, basically what they wanted to have was just get rid of Somoza and have a cross-class government that is made up of the guerrillas themselves and of the bourgeois opposition with a mixed economy. By 1977, this group, the Terceristas, had become to dominate the FSLN. Mike Gonzalez, who wrote this book, Revolution Under Siege, describes it this way. He said, none of the three tendencies discussed the question of socialism or saw the relationship between the construction of a revolutionary party rooted in the working class and the nature of state power after a revolutionary overthrow of the Somoza state. The role of the working class was not specifically discussed. There was no concept of workers' power, no sense of what a worker state would be like, no preparation of a material basis for such a state. In part, the lack of discussion was the fruit of the particular history of the FSLN, of its emergence and growth outside the working class movement, tiny though it was. So the Marxism of the FSLN was really Castroism, the idea of the masses boosting the revolutionary group into power. It was not the kind of working class self-emancipation that is usually identified with Marxism or the Bolshevik Party tradition or the Trotskyist tradition. In 1977 on, the shift of their politics went even further from the nominal goal of revolutionary power and a nationalized economy like Cuba to one of a mixed economy. I want to talk briefly about the FSLN in power. Once they took over in 1979, they were in a really dire state. The state of Nicaragua had $3.5 million in the bank. That was it. The rest of it had been looted by Somoza. Agricultural production had gone down 25%. Industrial activity had ceased in June and July. So their goal was to restart production and have political pluralism and collaborate with the bourgeoisie. As Mike Gonzalez puts it, the mass involvement in the overthrow of Somoza had pointed to the potential for developing a mass revolutionary organization, but only the potential. What had unified that movement had not been any ideas concerning workers' power or workers' councils. The only stated objective of the insurrection was the overthrow of Somoza. The manner in which the overthrow happened provided the opportunity for the posing of the issue of socialism, that is mass revolutionary control, democratic control of the economy. Instead, the central issue posed by the Sandinistas was the problem of accumulation of capital and national development. To get the aid necessary to rebuild the economy, they had two choices. They could try to spread the revolution, as the Bolshevik Party had done and tried to do in Russia when they took power in 1917, that is, take an international working class revolutionary approach, or they could accommodate to domestic and international capitalists. The latter is what the FSLN chose to do. So the initial policies of the FSLN were to nationalize the Somoza's holdings, which is about 40% of the economy. They took control of banking, insurance, import and export, and they tried to give incentives to the capitalists to keep their capital in Nicaragua. They promoted co-ops on state land and among private owners, but their priority was accumulation of capital. They pursued independent national development and competition in a world economy to try to develop the economy as the bourgeoisie had not been able to do. However, to lay the basis for popular support for their policies, they also instituted very many progressive programs as well. They instituted a mass literacy campaign, which rapidly lowered the amount of illiteracy in Nicaragua. They set up housing and so forth. For the first time, they set up a national health service, which had never existed before, and instituted a universal education. So there was a lot of social programs that were promoted by the FSLN, which got a lot of popular support, and for which people identified with the revolution. They also promoted agricultural co-ops on state land and among small farmers. However, this is all combined with an overall austerity approach and the decline in, quote, luxury consumption and the actually lowering of the overall wage expenditure. So it was an increase in the social wage, but a holding down of actually money wages. This was backed up by the limitations on the right to strike, which they first argued for on the basis of national unity. And then the right to strike was actually outlawed in Nicaragua between 1981 and 1984. However, the bourgeoisie was always encouraged to produce, and their consumption was allowed. From 1981 on, there was a state of emergency, which limited dissent and, as I said, outlawed the right to strike. In 1981, there was an agricultural reform which allowed them to take over unused land that had been unused by the capitalist owners, as well as on state land. They maintained good relationships with the sections of the bourgeoisie for 8 months. They were in power in the junta, along with the FSLN. There then developed a fight over a new state institution called the Council of State. The FSLN decided that it was going to make sure that it had a majority on the Council of State, and the bourgeoisie didn't like that because they wanted to have a majority. So by May of 1981, large sections of the bourgeoisie had gone over to the opposition, and in some cases that meant over to the armed opposition in the Contras. The goal of the Sandinista government was a popular front, really, an alliance between the guerrillas and the capitalists with the FSLN dominant. They favored capital accumulation by the bourgeoisie through taxes, subsidies, etc., but they restricted capital export because they wanted to keep the capital in Nicaragua to develop the economy. And that antagonized the bourgeoisie. They didn't like that. They wanted to be able to take their money any place they wanted to go. Their relationship with the popular classes, the workers and peasants and so forth, was, people supported them, but on the other hand, there were restrictions. The real power lay in with the Sandinistas rather than with any real popular democracy. In July of during the revolution itself, there were only 500 members of the FSLN when they took power. A year later, there were only 1,000 members of the FSLN. The leaders of the popular organizations, the Sandinista defense committees, the unions, and so forth, were chosen by the FSLN from the top down and not elected. As Mike Gonzalez puts it, the role of the mass organizations has been to cement the political hegemony of the FSLN and to win mass support for the initiatives and strategies of the state. They were not democratic mass organizations. They are firmly controlled both directly by the FSLN and indirectly by the general constraints on public debate and criticism within the national emergency law. There were various forms of workers' participation aimed at labor discipline, but also aimed at preventing decapitalization by the private sector. So they wanted to encourage workers to be involved in checking the capitalists, but they didn't want it to go too far. They actually opposed strikes against decapitalization in some cases. The FSLN used its political hegemony to convince workers and peasants not to make too many demands. And they accommodated some demands, but not others, because the main goal was accumulation of capital. Now, this was all intensified by the Contra War, which started in 1982. As I said, 50,000 lives were lost, at least $1 billion in damages. And by 1990, the Sandinistas had to devote 62% of their budget to the military as a result of that. In 1984, they were under pressure to have a bourgeois election, to elect a parliament and so forth, instead of moving away, instead of having the kind of revolutionary organs of power that they had started with. So they had a bourgeois election, and they won it very handily. But in spite of that, the United States and the opposition and so forth said it wasn't really a clean election. Some of the bourgeois forces had not run in the election because they said it was stacked against them and so forth. It was actually quite an open election, and the FSLN won it handily. In 1988, there was a ceasefire and resettlement of some of the Contras. But on the other hand, the war continued. And real consumption by the population was going down. It fell by 8% in 1984 alone. Real wages went down 35% between 1981 and 1984. The people's stores, which were set up to give subsidized goods to the poor, became less and less available and were actually closed down in 1988. The dollar stores aimed at the bourgeoisie, however, were left open. The percentage of private land rose in the late 80s. And illiteracy, which had been down to 12% in 1981, was back up to 30% by 1990. Infant mortality was again rising from 1986 on. So there was a new election in 1990, again pressured by the U.S., and this time the Sandinistas lost the election. And the reason for this is put forward by Mike Gonzalez. The result by February 25th, 1990, was that the mass of Nicaraguans had come to realize that this state for which they had fought and the sacrifices that they had made were continuing to make would not come to their own benefit, but would benefit those who were now leading the partners in the alliance that the Sandinistas had built. If so many voted for the UNO, that it was the bourgeois opposition, it was because that, at least, might end the contra-aggression. So that was kind of how the revolution was wound up, and we can get into the situation in Nicaragua today. But just like to briefly give an overall evaluation, first of all, it was a victory. The revolution in 1979, it's a major victory against U.S. imperialism and an inspiration to struggle throughout Latin America. There were progressive changes, as I said, healthcare, housing, education, etc. It was overall what we might call a kind of a unique situation of a revolutionary social democracy, in the sense that it was revolutionary in that they rose up and they smashed the old state and got rid of it. What they replaced it with, however, was not state capitalism like Cuba or a worker state where workers really ran things, but they established a popular front government allied with the bourgeoisie on top of a new revolutionary state pursuing capitalist interests of development. So it was kind of a unique revolutionary situation. They represented its defense of the bourgeois interests and the priority of accumulation as being in the interest of the masses. This put the FSLN in a dilemma similar to what Engels described about Munzer, who was a leader in the peasant war in Germany in the 1500s. They claimed to be representatives of the interests of the masses, but put themselves in a position of defending the capitalists. As Engels put it, the worst thing that can befall the leader of an extreme party is to be compelled to take over a government in an epoch when the movement is not yet ripe for the domination of the class which he represents and for the realization of the measures which that domination would imply. What he can do depends not upon his will, but on the degree of development of the material means of existence. Thus, he necessarily finds himself in a dilemma. What he can do is in contrast to all his principles and to the present interests of his party. What he ought to do cannot be achieved. In a word, he is compelled to represent not his party or his class, but the class for whom the conditions are ripe for domination. In the interests of the movement itself, he is compelled to defend the interests of the alien class and to feed his own class with phrases and promises, with the assertion that the interests of the alien class are their own interests. Whoever puts himself in this awkward position is irrevocably lost. So the revolution was limited because it was nationalist and based on an alliance of the capitalists, and the limitations ultimately led to its defeat in 1990. However, this does not diminish the importance of the popular victory. I think some of the lessons we can learn from this is that even the most repressive regimes can be overthrown. And there's many examples of that, but this is a very good one. Revolutions will break out. When the conditions are, as Lenin put forward, the conditions for revolution are when the ruling class can no longer rule in the old way, which was the case in Nicaragua, and when the oppressed classes refuse to be ruled in the old way. And those conditions came together in Nicaragua. I think one of the lessons is that our first obligation is solidarity. There were many of the problems that Nicaragua had were foisted upon it by the U.S. We need to oppose any U.S. intervention, whether political, military, or economic, which all serve the same ends of enforcing capitalist priorities over human needs. There is no such thing as no support to a liberal or conservative intervention. through human rights or the IMF or anything like that. It's all for the same purpose. Another lesson we can learn is that isolated revolutions cannot survive. Full national independent development is impossible in a world of imperialism, especially for a small country. We need to rebuild the Marxist tradition here and around the world so that future revolutions will be more likely to be influenced by the working class revolutionary Marxist tradition rather than the guerrilla tradition of Castro. As Mike Gonzalez put it at the end of his book, of course, as fighters against the gendarme of the 20th century, the FSLN are entitled to the unqualified support of all socialists. Arguably, though, a genuinely socialist government at the head of a newly created worker state would have acted differently. An alternative to Sandinista's constant search for an all-class alliance would have been an attempt to widen the political horizons of the revolution beyond Nicaragua's borders. At the same time, it would have been sought to create and strengthen democratic workers' organizations. For all the Sandinistas' attempts to appease and win over the patriotic bourgeoisie, the U.S. did arm the Contras to subvert a popular revolution. In other words, the Sandinistas did not export revolution, but the U.S. did export counter-revolution. For the socialists, the only way to defend revolution is to deepen it, and only the working class and poor peasants have an interest in doing this.
Thank you very much. So the floor is open for discussion. Before you gather your thoughts and raise your questions, we have a couple of books here at the bookstore, Forging of American Empire and Militarism in Latin America and Beyond, The Economic Crisis that Leads to Military Interventions. Also, Eduardo Galeano, Open Events of Latin America. I think this is the book that was given to President Obama.
Yeah.
For his booklet, so get it on. Yeah. And a very interesting article about, goes back to 2006, about elections in Nicaragua with Daniel Ortega coming back into power and what that has led from 2006 and on. So get your information. A couple of books here that are not in our bookstore, but they're very interesting. Nicaragua, Revolt Under the Cage, both are by Mike Gonzalez. You might find them on Amazon or online. And Viva Nicaragua, What Went Wrong. So, without further ado, the floor is open for discussion. I'll questions, comments?
It's all clear. No questions. Huh?
Well, I'm interested in hearing you talk about the state of Nicaragua today.
Mm-hmm. Please, when you raise your hand, say your name and where you're coming from, okay?
I'm Summer from Portland.
Okay.
I'm Stefania from Olympia.
Yeah.
So you briefly mentioned that literacy rates went up after the Sandinistas took power. What role did education play within the revolution? And what did that education look like? I know that there was a strong political or a popular education movement. And yes, yeah, so I guess I'm trying to.
How did that fit?
What was the makeup?
Oh, sorry.
My name is Ricardo from San Francisco. What was the makeup of the contrast, basically? Like the makeup, the ethnic makeup of the.
Wael from Portland. I was just struck because the it seems like the Nicaraguan Revolution, in a lot of ways, not only did it happen in the same year, but it's a lot very similar, at least in the interaction between the social groupings and the state. From what I know, the Shah had really centralized power as well and was really alienated from the bourgeoisie, from the petty bourgeoisie in Iran and the Bazaaris. And the working class in that revolution didn't begin to protest, get in the streets until a little bit later, because the Tuda party and the Communist Party essentially of Iran had been oppressed for so long by the Savak. And what had happened was that party, the working class had no real way to be able to express itself, and was in a lot of ways driven to the was forced, the only place left for them to be able to express themselves and express their displeasure with the Shah was through the mosque, because that was the only place left with repression. How much, I guess, looking at that in the future today, how important is sort of the networks that are available to the working class, and how much can their message be co-opted and changed depending on what networks they're forced into to sort of express themselves?
I'm Nicolita. I'm from Israel. I'm wondering if you can speak about, or if you know about the popular sentiment in Nicaragua about the FSLN, or just basically what's going on now with the FSLN.
Today, or?
Yeah.
Steve is going to come back to answer, because there's a lot of questions, and that can give us some space for, you know, comments.
First of all, is there anybody who would like to take on any of these questions in the audience? Okay. The two questions came up about what the situation today, how much support do they have, and so forth. In the election in, I believe it's 2006, they got about 36 to 37% of the vote. And the way things are divided up, the Constitution is set up so they don't have a runoff, so that was actually enough to get Daniel Ortega elected president. So they do have a significant amount of support. However, at least on that basis, it's not a majority support at this point. One of the ways that they... could we close that, or is that too hot? Okay, never mind. Okay, the situation.
Moving right along.
Speak a little louder. Basically, what happened is, from the time they were ousted from power, they began to make alliances with the more conservative bourgeois groups. I mean, it was kind of laid the basis for it during the time that they were in power, but they continued those kind of alliances, and it got really extreme. The FSLN has moved to the right and adopted some neoliberal policies. It's complicated because they've also gotten recently, this article goes into it, and people should take a look at that, and there's other articles, and the NACLA reports has articles on it and so forth. But basically, it's a very complicated situation. They're getting some money from Hugo Chavez, so they're able to use some money to give patronage support to some of their supporters. And at the same time, they're making alliances with more conservative forces. One sign of this is that Daniel Ortega and his partner had been together for 20 years or so, never been married, decided to make an alliance with the Catholic Church, declared themselves to be devout Catholics, and had the Archbishop Bravo, who had been a diehard opponent of the Sandinistas, perform the wedding ceremony. So they became official Catholics and, you know, and so forth. Now, one sign of this was that they ordered the FSLN deputies in the parliament to vote for an extreme anti-abortion bill. Nicaragua had an anti-abortion bill. However, there was a loophole for women, for the life of the mother. That loophole was taken out as a result of the FSLN and the other forces together deciding to strengthen the abortion law in a reactionary direction. So these are kind of examples of what's going on today. And the other thing is there's reports that the FSLN is, you know, basically, to be honest, according to these reports, and I, you know, haven't been to Nicaragua, but I'm, you know, basing it on which are usually progressive sources like NACLA and so forth, have taken up kind of thuggish behavior in terms of attacking the opposition and, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's kind of deteriorated, although Ortega is seen as one of the more left-wing, you know, he's seen as coming out of that revolutionary tradition, so he's one of the left governments, and I think he's in the Bolivarian Pact and so forth. So it's a complicated situation, but it's not good. Let's put it that way. So there definitely need, if there needed to be a real Marxist alternative in Nicaragua before, and there certainly needs to be one now. As far as the role of education that was raised during the course of the revolution, I mean, one element of the revolution which was very important was the Christian-based communities, which were very, very strong, and many of the Sandinista leaders actually came out of that, came out of the, you know, I just talked about the archbishop who was on the right wing of the whole operation. The left wing were the liberation theology, local priests, and so forth, and they contributed a lot to the revolution. There's a lot of education that went on in the course of that in the Christian-based communities, and I think that was a big part of it. However, the FSLN, even up to the time it took power, was not well-rooted in the masses of people. It was, as I said, only 500 members when it took power, and it had a lot of, in some ways it was similar to Cuba in the sense that there was a lot of support for it, but it wasn't like well-rooted. And so the direct education that the FSLN engaged in among the masses was probably not as important as some, you know, like the Christian-based communities and that kind of thing. Then the question about the similarity to the Iranian Revolution, that's a really interesting thing, and people, for more discussion of that, there's a really good book called Revolutionary Rehearsals, which are available out here. It has a chapter on Iran. I think my interpretation would be a little bit different in that in the case of Iran, the workers were more well organized, and they actually set up workers' councils in the court. And I think you're right, it was a little bit later on. But they did, in the course of the revolution, they began to set up councils, especially in the oil industry, and they went on strike. And that was a big part of what caused the overthrow of the Shah. So they were more organized on a working class basis during the course of the revolution, as opposed to the workers in Nicaragua, which were more likely to be in tiny factories and less organized, and didn't set up anything that we could consider really to be workers' councils. But I do think you're right that whatever is available to people will influence the course of the struggle. And I think, but what happened in Iran was that there was actually a fight between the workers' councils that were set up independently by the working class, and then the what they call the Islamic councils, which were imposed by the new Islamic government as a way to actually wrest power from the workers and put it in the hands of the state. So there was a real struggle that was going on in the first year of the revolution, which was not just about that, it was about the workers, but it was also about the suppression of the women's movement and the independent, the movements of the oppressed and so forth in the different areas of Iran. So it was a real struggle that went on. In the case of Nicaragua, the struggle was not as intense in that the workers were not as independently organized. They tended to support, in a loose way, the FSLN, and so they would go along with some of their calls for not going on strike and that kind of thing. There was some resistance, but there was more support, I think, for the FSLN, because people saw it as their movement, and, you know, they just together had overthrown the Somoza dictatorship.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about some of the mobilization that occurred inside and beyond Nicaragua and all of this, because the FSLN's original leadership was following on the Cuban example, but it's usually said that the Nicaraguan Revolution happened with a much higher level of mobilization, and I agree with Steve about that it wasn't organized as politically distinct organization, but when you talk about things like these uprisings in the cities of Esteli and León and Matagalpa and León, I mean, the entire city was taken over by an uprising as the revolution began to reach its crescendo, and there were only 500 FSLN members, just like there was a pretty small number of Cuban guerrillas when they took over the state. But it was much more difficult to take over the Nicaraguan state because the government fought back hard. I mean, the Cuban army sort of fell apart as part of the march of Castro and those people into power. There was a very fierce repression with aerial bombardment of Managua leading up to 1979, and the much higher level of popular mobilization was essential in putting the Sandinistas into power. It also happened in the context of a revolutionary wave in neighboring El Salvador, and I remember a guy I knew in the early 90s at the end of the Solidarity movement with the Central American Revolutions, who he had fled El Salvador in the late 70s. We always thought we were going to have the revolution first. Mm-hmm. And they had a very urban-based, mass mobilization-based strike wave type of revolution. And one of the impacts of it was of the Nicaraguan Revolution, which triumphed in state power before it, was to then militarize and take the Salvadoran Revolution out of the cities and into the countryside. And I mean, it's Steve talked about the FSLN not trying to export the revolution. I mean, in one sense, they did. They did try to coordinate guerrilla groups in Guatemala and El Salvador and maybe Colombia, which all those had a little bit of a upswing at that period of time. But the real impact on El Salvador, I think, I would say, was to take the revolution out of where it was strongest, because you had all of a sudden this powerful example from neighboring Nicaragua of, wow, they actually got rid of Somoza and he's gone now and they're running the country and they're doing a massive literacy program. So it took the struggle out of the cities in El Salvador and basically led to a situation where the FMLN, which was a merger of factions negotiated by the FSLN, was really not able to accomplish any significant changes in El Salvador in the course of a long, difficult civil war. But there was also a significant solidarity movement globally. I have a friend who was part of a Swiss Trotskyist group in the 80s. They sent people to work on the farms in Nicaragua and even do guard duty and so forth. A lot of people from the United States did, and there was a boycott of coffee made in El Salvador, where the West Coast dock workers refused to take Folgers coffee into the ports. They cut off 25% of the supply. Some of it got through the Gulf Coast, but as far as the West Coast entry of Folgers coffee from El Salvador, they couldn't do that for years because the union here wouldn't do it, because the unions in El Salvador, which were trying to still resist, asked for that kind of solidarity. And, we talk about sanctuary cities today, that which are, you know, we want them to be put in place for the benefit of undocumented immigrants, from many from Mexico, but also from Central America. Mm-hmm. Those really got started as a concept because of church-based, what was called the sanctuary movement at that time, which was sheltering refugees from Nicaragua and El Salvador in the Civil War. Many of them were leftists and so forth. Not all of them were. Many from Guatemala also. And they created sanctuary cities that said, we're not going to cooperate with deportation proceedings to send people back into a war zone. A government that refuses to recognize that people are political refugees because it's allied with the government that's killing them. It was basically a mass civil disobedience movement, taking people into their homes and breaking the law, and then pushing the local governments to create sanctuary cities. This is a concept that we have for the immigrants' rights movement today.
Thank you. Ian?
Hi, I'm Ian from Vancouver in Canada, and I wanted to say that I really appreciate the nuts and bolts of your talk, especially that the amount of money in the bank that the Sandinistas got to was only $4 million. Fine. Does that happen in San Francisco a lot? Why I'm raising that? That's not a lot of money, and you would think, and so it would be really important. You want to show, perhaps, if you wanted to show solidarity, if you know, comrade had $1 million to send, that would be pretty good. And it just so happened that in about the time of the revolution, Canada was having its first Olympic lottery to pay for the Olympics that we had in 1976 and just finished paying for them last year. And then we'll have a new one next year, which we will keep paying for, but we don't have an Olympic lottery for that. Anyway, a comrade in Toronto, not one of our comrades, but won the Olympic lottery, which at that time the prize was $1 million. Now, you've also talked at the end of the talk about how solidarity needed to be built beyond Nicaragua to have it succeed. And quite often I know that in every country that has a huge military budget, some peace organization says, could we have like one fighter jet, that budget for peace? What could we do with that? Work it out. Everybody has seemed to have done that. And I wish that that comrade in Toronto had not known that, you know, that the Sandwiches only had $4 million and could have really probably used that extra money, but she sent it to them. But if she maybe thought that, you know, we could have built something massive across Canada with $1 million. Okay, I know that's only 900,000 American dollars, but it was something. Okay, it was something that we could have used. And so that's what I want to say.
Thanks. Any last round of hands, comments?
My question is sort of, what were the immediate concrete demands of people beyond the fact that they were living underneath a brutal dictator? And I'm just trying to get sort of a sense of sort of what were the immediate demands that came from the movement? Because usually there is some sort of gap between the leadership, especially when it's sort of like basically a top-down, guerrilla-led movement where the masses are sort of used to drive a movement that puts them into power, into a new state. So what was there? Were there demands that were raised that the Sandinistas had to sort of damp down? And what did that... Yeah, I'm just trying to get a sense of sort of the demands that came from the bottom up.
My name is Miguel. I'm from San Francisco. I kind of like to touch base on like what happened with the Contras and whatnot. And basically, from what I understand, the Contras came as a result of the United States trying to meddle in the aftermath of the Sandinista Revolution. So basically, they told them, you need to not export revolution to El Salvador. You need to hold elections, amongst other things. You need to drop expropriation of various companies, and you need to not you need to pay the loans that were given to the previous the government, you know, Somoza. Obviously, it's their own country; they can do what they want. They said, "No, fuck you. You know, we're gonna hold elections when we feel like it." So the government, the U.S. government, started not only mining the harbors of Nicaragua, which destroyed their import-export business. They gathered up a group of exiled ex-Somoza. Ex-Somoza counter-revolutionaries and opposition people had them trained by the military government in Argentina, started operating from Honduras, committed atrocities, started drug trafficking to fund their activities. I'm not sure if too many people are familiar with what Iran-Contra was. It basically was, they started selling, the U.S. government, in order to try to get the hostages freed, hostages freed from Iran, started selling Iran overpriced U.S. missiles. With the money from these sales, it started funneling them into the Contras. Mind you, at the time, this was legal under the Boland Amendment, which cut off aid, official U.S. government aid to the Contras. So, not only were they getting guns, also brokered by Israel. Israel was in the mix, selling them guns. But they were also engaged in drug trafficking and flooding the United States with cocaine, which at the time started the crack explosion.
Right.
Yeah. And basically, this pretty much went on until like 1992,1991, when they were pretty much voted out of office. And,
Just one other point that you were talking about, how this should be seen by socialists as a huge victory.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the region during that time, you have you know, in Chile, there was a, you know, popular movement to get Allende as president, and the U.S. basically via the School of the Americas gets Pinochet, who has this, you know, brutal dictatorship from 74 or whatever he came in to whenever the fuck he died. I mean, he basically was around for a long time, and I think that, you know, this was an example of, you know, people basically thumbing the nose at U.S. imperialism in that region, because it had such, you know, just a brutal legacy in Central America as well as in Iran. And I think that you can't talk about this kind of period of history about U.S. imperialism without bringing up these examples of victories.
Oh, one thing I forgot to mention. Reagan actually had the nerve to call the Contras the
freedom fighters.
Yeah. Not freedom fighters, but the ideological brothers of the founding fathers of the United States.
That's right.
And I want to throw myself in as a last, I don't see any other hands. So, yeah, I agree with John saying that this was a very impressive and victory of working class people across Latin America. It gave, you know, it raised the level of expectations of other activists and working class people around the globe. At the same time, during that revolution, it was highlighted the problems with FSLN, the problems of the organization of the party, the problems that led to, you know, its deflation and its being kicked out of elections in the 1990s. So although the FSLN had a base, it was not a social base that were spreading out. They were not building any workers' councils immediately. So everything, and there was an ideological trying to rethink about Marxist ideas, how to spread the revolutionary ideas around the globe, and it was not very clear which way to go. So they had to move in a certain direction. And unfortunately, they moved to the direction of socialism from above and, you know, no connection with the social movement. So when there was time and time again, the social movements tried to come back, Sandinistas, and reclaim back wages, increases. Sandinistas and the leadership of the Sandinista movement went back repressing them really brutally. I mean, saying that there are no strikes allowed. Some historic members of the FSLN were kicked out in isolation, and new leadership came in trying to collaborate to have this realistic approach for revolution and not the revolutionary ideas, and make it compact with the bourgeois class in a mixed kind of economy. And this is lessons for us today. Like, what are socialists saying about those revolutions? They're great, but we need to be really clear about which road we are going to go through. So I think it opens a debate about what party, what kind of revolution do we want, what do we mean by working class emancipation, what do we mean by all those. And I think the discussion will go on for after also the conference. So thanks for letting me in. Yes, and Kevin, if there's nobody else, I'll take... Kevin will be our last speaker.
It's actually one that reminds me of one thing, which is I think, unfortunately I can't claim to know either of the Nicaraguan or Iranian revolutions particularly well, but from what I understand, I mean, it's clearly the sense of the limitations, the effects of Stalinism on the left in general, I think, are visible in both cases, in the sense of the sort of focus on national revolutions and rather than social. And I think, you know, people were talking about earlier what happened to the labor, you know, the shores, the workers' councils in Iran. My understanding is that part of what happened was that the leading organization left was the Communist Party there, which basically had disarmed the workers in the face of the Iranian revolution, the Islamic Revolutionary Councils, because, you know, Iran was not yet, it was basically, you know, in its staged system, it was ready for national revolution, not socialist revolution. And that was part of the reason why labor was able to be defeated. But I think I'm sure Steve can elaborate on that.
Okay, before I give it back to you, I have some announcements. So you know that Haymarket Bookstore is open here and Women's Building, and they will be open during the dinner break. Mark Steele is have a special 4th of July dinner stand-up tribute to Tom Paine here. So dinner will not be provided, so grab dinner and come back and enjoy. If you'd like to become a member of the International Socialist Organization, there is a recruitment office down in Women's Building. During dinner time, come and talk to us and check out your 2-9 schedule to see where your meeting is located. And I hope you all know by now there are like 2 places, Women's Building here. And please make sure to wear or show your tag. We have some kind of security issues during nighttime sessions, so please be kind with the security team. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So just a couple of questions have come up, and you know, I forgot to bring up the makeup of the contras. That question was asked. It goes largely answered, but there are kind of 2 sources of it. There was the old National Guard that had been defeated in Nicaragua. Some of them were arrested, others left the country, and so forth. And they reconstituted a big part of the contra movement, especially in Honduras. Another wing of that was the disaffected people in the FSLN who basically broke with the FSLN and also the bourgeois opposition, which funded them. And a wing of the Contras was in Costa Rica under the leadership of Aiden Pastora, who had been a big leader of the Sandinistas, who was called Commander Zero, and had been involved in all sorts of raids and so forth. But he was a moderate element in the Sandinistas, and he finally went over to the Contras. So that was on the basis of that. But also, I mean, the point about the U.S. is really has to be stressed. It was the U.S. funding, it was the U.S. support, right, and so forth. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't for that, yeah, you could argue that there might have been some kind of Contra activity without that, but the way it came down and the damage it did and the effects it had were all because of the U.S. And that is something that we organized against along with all sorts of other people, and it's really important. Unfortunately, it didn't have the kind of effect that it should have had. The question of demands. I don't know that there was, because things were organized through the Sandinistas and without a lot of independent, explicit independent movements. I haven't seen any like list of demands that other people had and so forth before the revolution. The main thing was to get rid of the regime. However, once the revolution took place, there were conflicts in terms of people in the countryside took over land they occupied, and the Sandinistas had a very strict relationship. They said, well, wait a minute, you can't occupy the lands of the patriotic bourgeoisie, right? They're people who support us, so you're going to have to go back, right? Now, if you want to occupy some of the land that we took from Somoza, well, that's a whole different story. So there was like clampdowns on the occupations that people in the countryside put forward. Same thing happened in the cities, where in some cases, the workers would occupy factories in order to stop decapitalization, which supposedly was the Sandinista demand. They wanted the capital to stay in Nicaragua. And so it should have been, they should have supported that. And yet they said, well, wait a minute, that's going to alienate the bourgeoisie. We don't want that to happen. And then, of course, there was opposition to wage demands and so forth. And that was another big part of it. I think overall, one of the big lessons we need to learn is that the conditions that Lenin put forward for revolution will take place. There will be divisions in the bourgeoisie where they're not going to be able to rule in the old way. And to a certain extent, I mean, we're not in a revolutionary crisis right now, but we see the glimmers of that in that they had neoliberalism. They're not able to rule in that way anymore. They have to do something different, right? So there are splits about how to do that. But the other side of that that's just as important or more important is that the masses of people have to decide that they are not willing to be ruled in the old way. And that condition has not yet been met. Those conditions will be met in the United States. We need to realize that. And when they do, we need to be organized. And we need to be clear that if the rebellions will take place, the revolts will take place, the revolutions will happen. That is foregone conclusion in capitalism. The only question is, will they be effective? Will they be well organized? Will we win? And that has to do with politics and organization. So the key lesson we need to learn, I think, is that the revolution's coming. It will come. The question is, will we be ready for it? Let's get ready for it.
Thank you.